Hi again, and welcome to another episode of the It's Not Brain Surgery podcast, the AANS Practice and Business Management podcast. I'm your host for today's episode, Paul Camerata, and we're really excited to have with us Professor Sean Liu. Sean will talk to us today about communication tips and how to break bad news, tips and guides for that. Dr. Liu is the Mardak Vandenberg Family Chair of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Children's Wisconsin and a professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also the director of the residency program there and director of epilepsy surgery. He has subspecialty training in pediatric neurosurgery and is board certified both in adult and pediatric neurosurgery with a special interest in the surgical treatment of pediatric epilepsy, brain tumors, Moyamoya disease, and craniocervical anomalies. He also is active in clinical research with an emphasis on epilepsy and cervical spine surgery. His fellowship was in pediatric neurosurgery at the Beth Israel Medical Center, Hyman Newman Institute for Neurology and Neurosurgery in New York, and residency at the University of Vermont, and his MD at OHSU in Portland. Dr. Liu, welcome to the AANS podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Paul.
Well, we were talking off mic a little bit about the importance of breaking bad news, something that oftentimes residents don't see. What are a couple of guiding principles that you would share to help break bad news to a patient?
Sure. Yeah, I think I have a few to share. I think to start with, it's important to have a plan. Collect yourself. Think about what you need to convey. Mm-hmm. And I'll just kind of go down what I think about. Where is it going to happen? Do you have the appropriate privacy? Is it an appropriate setting? If you need to show them imaging, you know, do you have a setup for that? Are there distractions in the room, or are there little kids running around? Like, how do you create a space where you can have a talk, where you can be heard? I think about my personal appearance. I've made the mistake, as I'm sure many surgeons have, of having a talk with somebody and getting back to the locker room and seeing like a little mist of blood on my mask or something. That must be horrific for somebody to see. So just quick check on that. I consider the environment sometimes for my own personal safety. Sometimes with traumas, people you've never met before, middle of the night, empty surgery waiting room, people can react in a very emotional way. And I think sure. That's just something to keep in mind for the environment. I think it's important to be clear in your head what you want to convey. You know, like, this isn't the time to kind of walk in and start winging it, thinking about what your plan is or what the prognosis is. If there are decisions that you need to get from the patient or their family, you know, have that all kind of mapped out in your head. You really can't wing it, and anticipate the questions. And then I would say, if you're a trainee, be very honest and frank about your role and the level of your role, and don't talk yourself into a corner committing to a plan that might be overruled by somebody else, and just avoid absolutes. You know, your fund of knowledge may not be, you know, have this wealth of experience that somebody more seasoned would have. And so avoid saying things with 100% certainty. You can say, in my experience, this, or, you know, I'm concerned about that, but not never or always. And, you know,
that right thing. So the appearance thing is something very important that I know when you're young, you don't think of that much. I mean, the residents are traipsing around the hospital with blood in their pants and shoe covers and all of that stuff. But imagine what a family thinks when you come out and your shoe covers are covered with blood and you're standing there talking to them about some bad news. So I don't think you can stress that enough.
Yeah, it's certainly embarrassing for yourself. But yeah, I mean, we're so used to it. But, you know, if you're not medical, it's got to be pretty, pretty bad.
Yeah, I went to a CNS summer executive committee meeting, one of these, it was 20 years ago, and it was at a place where it was owned by the owner of MBNA at the time, Charles Colley, and he had above every door the words, "Consider yourself a client." And I came home after that and put little signs up in our office that said, "Consider yourself a patient." You know, think of what you want when some physician's coming to tell you bad news. How would you like to be addressed? And you'd certainly want to see somebody clean and without the signs of the recent misadventure, perhaps in the operating room. Do you take? We also talked off mic. I don't take, or I haven't until recently, residents to watch me give the bad news sometimes after the operating room. Is that something that you do? How else do you teach them on how to deliver bad news?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's not something that I routinely do, and I probably should. And it reminds me of when I was a resident, I was an intern when we did general surgery internships, and I was an intern on the pediatric surgery service. And it was a bad trauma, neurotrauma. And I remember the attending at the time was taking me into the room to talk to this family about this bad head trauma. And I was anticipating, like, this is going to be great. I'm going to learn something here from this guy. And we walked into the room, and he's like, "This is Dr. Liu from neurosurgery. He's going to tell you about the injury."
Totally blindsided.
But yeah, I mean, it is something that I confess I didn't look at this topic until yesterday. And it made me think about, this isn't something that is part of our regular curriculum, and it certainly should be, because it's something that everybody who is in our field can look back and go, "Gosh, I'm much better at this than I was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Sure. Yeah, I'm making a concerted effort now when I remember to wait to talk to the family until the case is over. And because a lot of times the resident will be closing the skin or whatever, and then you go say hi to the family, give them all the news, and the resident's still in the room tidying up and getting the patient to the ICU, whatever, to now trying to wait for all of that to be done, take the resident with me just so they see how I deliver the news, especially in the case of bad news to a family, and hopefully that will help them in the future. I've also thought about having we have a liaison. I know a lot of places do, where there's a nurse that floats between rooms and keeps everybody in the waiting area apprised of what's going on in the OR. Maybe having her come and speak with, and she's very good, speak with the residents and do sort of almost a formal didactic, talk on how you break bad news. What are the best ways to talk to family? You must encounter that, gosh, on an almost daily basis with the pediatric patients and the type of surgery that you do.
Gosh, I hope it's not daily.
No, not bad news daily. I mean, just difficult news sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely comes up more than you want, for sure.
You mentioned some of the missteps, your appearance, not paying attention to your appearance, not having planned out in advance what you want to say. What are some of the other common missteps that neurosurgeons can take when they're communicating bad news?
Yeah, sure. I think it really matters where, the family or the patient, it's usually a family for me, parents, and so I'll just speak with that perspective, like, where are they coming from? So it's definitely a different conversation if you have a relationship with them. And, there's the bad news, like, oh, the tumor has recurred. And this is something they've been thinking about, they've been worrying about. Like, you can go straight from that to talking about, this is what we're going to do, this is what it means, these are the next steps. That's very different, I find, than somebody who, bad trauma, they're there, this is all happening right away. You don't know them, they don't know you. I've seen that happen where people start to get really technical and start saying, well, this is what's happening, and get very precise. And this is the principles of management of head trauma and ICP and da, 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 da. And you just know that they're not listening to any of that. They've heard that there's a bad trauma and then that their child may be in danger, and most of what you're saying is not being processed by them. So I definitely have learned this, that, people, when it's a really sudden, unexpected, horrible thing you're telling them, people need time to digest that. And you keep it simple, say, I'm really concerned, this is life-threatening, we're doing everything we can, and we'll be back to update you, you answer what you can. But I have found that that really matters, where people are coming from. I would say a lot of the stuff we do doesn't involve just us, right? There's other team members, there's other services sometimes, an ICU team, trainees, and it's important that everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
I find that particularly between the neurosurgery team and the intensive care team, the last thing you want is somebody else walking in that room that's giving a mixed message,
or you're telling them something different. Yeah.
So I always try to have an early communication with the ICU team or the trauma team, and this is what I'm telling them, or let's go in together to talk to them. You know, so, like, we're all on the same page and not contradicting each other, or somebody's giving a much more optimistic or pessimistic prognosis. So I think that's a potential misstep.
Yeah, and that's hard to walk back. You see, if you look on caring bridge sites and things like that, one of the biggest complaints is the physicians are saying different things. A critical care consultant walked in and said things look really miserable, and the next day somebody came in and said there's light at the end of the tunnel. It's like, well, which is it? You know. So it helps to be together, to gather together and get your story straight. How important is it to know a bit about the family, you know, like where they come from, what their jobs are, their employment status, economic status, what kind of a background, in your case, that the child comes from before you talk to them, and in how you talk to them? How important it is to use, you know, plain words, you know, nothing technical?
Yeah, I think that's the important part, is to make sure that you're speaking at an appropriate level with an appropriate vocabulary, you know, and not throwing out acronyms, not throwing out stuff that is medical level or college level, you know, just assume to keep it basic. I think that's really important. I don't know about economic status and educational level, but just we all can speak if we think about it in a way that's can be
understandable
to almost everybody. And
if somebody does make a misstep in their communication, what would you recommend they do next?
I guess it depends on the misstep. I think the times where people get into trouble is if they talk themselves into a corner, you know, maybe say something and back, you know, or, you know, they're not communicating with the rest of the team. And I think if you stick to the principles of just being honest and being honest about what you know and what you don't know, especially if you're a trainee, you know, like, I think this is what, but Dr. So-and-so is also going to weigh in. And I think recovery can be just being honest, whatever the misstep was. I shouldn't have said that. It turns out that we're not ready to make that decision, or that information's not here, or I misunderstood something. And I think if you show your humanity in these situations, if you're honest, if you show that you care and that it's okay to show your feelings, you're not speaking down to people, but you're speaking at their level. If you're not rushed, it's not that hard to recover a situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all very important points.
The other thing I would say is sometimes just time. I think we probably all had situations where it's kind of shoot the messenger. You know, you're giving the news and you become the bad guy. People are angry at you. They're kind of in denial about what's going on. And I find that, you know, like, you have to not take any of that personally. You got to give them the benefit of the doubt and give them space and try to put yourself in their shoes and just give them time, you know, and they may be yelling at you as you're walking out the door, but you can come back an hour later, a day later, and reestablish that relationship and not take it like they slighted me and now therefore da 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 da. Like, when you're in their shoes, like, it's just, they deserve all the benefit in the world, and I take nothing personal.
Yeah. So, for example, tell us how you break the news of a really malignant brain tumor. Do you or don't you tell them right up front a person's got 6 months to live or anything? Or do you use a little bit of time, like, you know, this is probably not good? And then as they gather more information, do some research on their own, and you talk to them the next day, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of a drawn out process, I guess.
Yeah. We kind of give warning shots, right? Like, we say, well, okay, this MRI is not good. We don't know for sure what it is, but it looks aggressive. And sometimes these things can be curable. Sometimes they're manageable, but not curable. And sometimes they're not survivable. Mm-hmm. And you just tell them what you know and what you don't know. I think you have to be really careful about the level of hope, right?
Yeah.
And it's pretty rare, right, that there's zero hope. Like, we're all familiar with these very crazy case reports and our personal experiences. Like, gosh, I thought that person would never survive, or this person's had a GBM for 15 years.
And
how is this possible? So those things exist, but also at the same time, you can't just paint this rosy picture that you know in your heart is untrue. But I almost never will give a time, you know. Like, I mean, somebody's going to have to really put a lot of pressure on me to bring out a number like 6 months or something, right? But you can tell, you know, if there's data that you can share, like, well, if, you know, the median survival is this, I think that's okay. But I think that scenario is kind of a gradual thing, you know. And I will typically, if I'm concerned that it's malignant, I'll tell them I'm concerned it's malignant. I don't know that yet. And then maybe the biopsy comes back, or the pathology comes back, and it is. And You convey that and say, sometimes this isn't survivable. Sometimes it is. I mean, there's almost no brain tumor that somebody hasn't survived, but you see the factors, it's not resectable completely, or this is, and that's better, or it's not. I think it's just being honest, not pretending to know things that you don't really know, or being certain about things that you shouldn't be certain about. I think people understand that.
Talk to us also about the importance of, when something bad does happen, continuing communication with the patient or the family. The tendency is, when you have a bad outcome or a bad complication or something that's unexpected, the tendency is you don't want to be faced with that every day. You don't want to deal with it. You kind of want to put it away. And I've even seen surgeons just sort of, well, let the ICU doc deal with that. I'm not going to talk to the family anymore because I hate seeing what has happened, and how important it is to continue to engage with that family or that patient.
Yeah, I think that's part of the job, right? Like, I think we all have those situations that there's this tendency you want to avoid it. I mean, that's a whole nother topic if it's a complication, you know, that you're responsible.
Right, yeah.
Right, like that's probably another podcast.
Different, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, you're just going to have to suck it up and walk in the room. And I think if you do it, it's appreciated 90%+ of the time, and it's not as bad as you thought. And I think we all have to kind of have that line in ourselves where we can be empathetic and feel that sadness without it overwhelming our wellness, right?
Yeah.
And so that I do think there's a role for kind of protecting yourself and not shedding tears every day about the patient that, you know, if you spend enough time thinking about it and dwelling on it enough, and that would be the case. So it's tough. But yeah, you definitely can't just walk away. You can't ignore the situation, particularly if you, you know, if you're the attending of record, if you're the one that's in charge of that patient care, like, you know, you have to stay engaged.
One kind of last question that you would have particular insight in: how different is it talking to kids and to their parents? How do you know, and I'm sure it's age dependent, all that, how much to tell a child or how much to tell the parent and then let the parent tell the child, et cetera?
Yeah, it's really tricky. I think you start with the parents and you get a feel from the parents of where that kid's at, what they know, what they don't know, what they're worried about or not. I think for kids, a lot of times they don't want to know everything, or they don't want to know all the details. You don't have to salt them over the head with all this information. At the same time, if they're asking me stuff, I'm answering them, and I'm answering them in a truthful way. And sometimes you have parents who are like, don't tell Johnny this, you know, like, we don't want that. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes it's something you have to educate the parents too, where they're creating more anxiety because there's certain kids that are aware something's up. You guys keep going out of the side of the room and talking about me and then telling me everything's okay. Like, you can't do that either. So I encourage the parents, like, we will both talk to the kid and we will both be honest, and we don't have to assault them with all this information. They're not asking for it. But these kids are very intuitive. They know when something's up. The worst thing that can happen is if they feel like they can't trust their parents or they can't trust me, you know, because they know that we're not being truthful, because they're smart enough to figure it out. Like, that's a terrible situation.
Sure. So
it's tricky though, and it totally depends on the kid and the age, right?
Yeah.
But I think those are the main principles. It's like, you have to be honest with them. If they ask you questions, you have to tell them the truth. You can tell it the nicest way possible, but you can't lose that trust. Particularly with their parents, I think. Like, it's so much anxiety, right? If you can't believe what your parents are telling you.
Well, it's a tricky situation for sure that fortunately many of us don't have to deal with. But you stalwarts in pediatric neurosurgery, it's hats off. Last question. Not sure how much of a sports fan you are, but Bucks or Brewers?
Oh, Bucks for sure.
For sure.
Not even close.
Oh, shoot. Well, that's great. Sean, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Paul.
Professor Sean Liu from Medical College of Wisconsin, the director of the residency program there and professor of pediatric neurosurgery. Really appreciated having you on today.
Yeah, good to see you. Thanks.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the It's Not Brain Surgery podcast. We're welcoming Maria Paracelda and Chetan Bedagowda to talk to us about teaching and learning in upcoming episodes in neuroanatomy and in the lab. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we'll talk talk to you next time.